You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And as promised on Friday, when Senator Sanders was out of town and unavailable to do brunch with Bernie today, he's with us right now. Senator Bernie Sanders over in the Senate studios. Senator, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And so today will be our special edition. We're going to do it again on Friday, a brunch with Bernie. By the way, check out Senator Sanders' website at sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, you were in Indiana, I understand, and I've got this story from reader-supported news with this huge headline, Sanders releases explosive bailout list. I went off on it a little bit on Friday, but would love to hear your thoughts on that, too.
Well, I was in Indiana on Friday, and that's the reason we didn't do the show, because the public sector workers there are really being, they're under very severe attack from Governor Mitch Daniels and the Republican legislature. So I thought it was important for me to be there, and it was a great opportunity. We had a great group of people coming out. The point that I made to them, Tom, is the point that I often make on the show, and that is if you understand economically what is happening in America, you understand that the middle class is being crushed, poverty is increasing, while the wealthiest people are doing phenomenally well. And there have been some statistics that come out, and I know I've mentioned these before, but it is important that everybody understands the degree to which the middle class is declining and the degree to which the gap between the very, very rich and everybody else is growing wider. I mean, what you have today now is the top 1% owning 40% of the wealth of America. That's the top 1%. Tom, do you know what the bottom 60% own in terms of wealth? Take a wild and crazy guess.
5 or 10%?
No, less than 2%.
Less than 2%, wow.
So you have the top 1% owning 40%, the bottom 60% owning less than 2%. You have one family, the Walton family, that obviously owns a Walmart. One family owns more wealth than the bottom 30% of the American people, about 90 million Americans.
This is like feudal Europe in the 10th century.
That's my point. That is exactly my point, and that's what we've got to understand. It is bad now, and it is getting worse. And one other statistic, the latest report that we had based on income distribution between 2010 and 2009, the last report that we saw, 93% of all income went to the top 1%. 7% of the new income went to the bottom 99%. That's new income between 2009 and 2010. So what you have is a situation in which the wealthiest people have it virtually all. But apparently, that is not enough for them. The fact that the top 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90% is just not good enough. So now what you're seeing, as a result of Citizens United, what you're now seeing is billionaires saying, we want it all. We want it all. So the Koch brothers, a family that is worth some $50 billion, are prepared to spend, we understand, according to the media, some $400 million in the coming election to defeat Obama and to defeat those candidates who stand with working people. But I have no reason to believe that that number may not even be greater. Sheldon Adelson, who is really quite a pauper compared to the Koch brothers, I think he's only worth $22 billion, not $50 billion. But he is prepared to spend at least $100 million, and that's what's going on. So you're seeing a union, if you like, of billionaires. This is the billionaires' union coming together to say that we need it all. And that is where we are politically right now. Now, they are supporting overwhelmingly the Republican Party, and the Republican agenda certainly reflects exactly what they want, and that is more tax breaks for the richest people in this country, despite the fact that they're already doing so well. You saw Mitt Romney a couple of weeks ago talking about more deregulation of Wall Street. I mean, this is like beyond comprehension. We are in this disaster right now of high unemployment, of lower wages, precisely because of the recklessness and the illegal behavior on Wall Street, because we deregulated them, and Romney's responses, we didn't go far enough. We've got to deregulate them even further. We have lost 60,000 factories in the last 10 years, millions of decent-paying manufacturing jobs, and what Romney and his friends want is more unfettered free trade. So what you have is one political party, the Republican Party, working hand in glove with the billionaires who are supporting their efforts. Sadly, while we have many Democrats who are standing up and fighting for working people, clearly there is not unanimity in the Democratic Party, and too many Democrats are working with corporate America as well. So what we need, and you and I have talked about this a million times, is we need a strong grassroots movement around a progressive agenda, and that agenda says, sorry, no more tax breaks for billionaires. They have to start paying their fair share of taxes. We need a jobs program to put millions and millions of people back to work, among other things, rebuilding our infrastructure, transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel, something, needless to say, the Koch brothers would not be enthusiastic about. And as we debate deficit reduction, what we have got to make sure is we do not move toward a balanced budget on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor by cutting Social Security, which had nothing to do with the deficit, Medicare or Medicaid. But what we are taking on now is an incredible, unprecedented assault from the billionaires who really want to destroy the middle class. And I think we've got to do everything that we can to fight back.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Fed, these banksters who got $4 trillion and they're on the board that is passing the money out?
Well, here's where we are with that. And we released a study on that. We've got legislation on that. Right now, in my view, we need a new Wall Street. Right now, you got six banks that control $9 trillion. That's equivalent to two-thirds of the GDP of America. Six financial institutions. And believe me, no matter what anyone will tell you, they are, quote-unquote, too big to fail. If they go under, they will be bailed out again. But what you need in order to create a new Wall Street, a Wall Street which invests in the productive economy, helps companies build products and create services, and in the process create jobs. In order to do that, you're going to need a strong Fed, whose job it is to supervise and regulate Wall Street. Sadly, and this is based on legislation that is very, very old, you have 12 regional Feds with 9 members each. 3 of the 9 members on the New York Fed and the other regional Feds come directly from the banking community. One of those folks on the New York Fed, people might be shocked to know, is a good friend, Jamie Dimon, head of the largest financial institution in America, J.P. Morgan Chase. There are 2 others from the banking community. On top of that, the banking community appoints another 3 people on the Fed. So 6 out of 9 people on regional Feds either come from the banking community or are appointed by the banking community. Now, how does that impact
that sounds
real
like
life?
That sounds like a rigged game to me.
If that is not a conflict of interest or the fox guarding the hen house, you know, then I don't know what is. Yeah. But what you saw during the bailout period is the Fed provided $16 trillion in revolving loans to every financial institution in America. Many of the institutions represented by bankers on the Fed received those loans, certainly including J.P. Morgan Chase and Jamie Dimon, who received over $300 billion in very, very low interest loans. So
wow.
We are working hard now to try to end that absurd conflict of interest, get the bank.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back with more of Senator Bernie Sanders. Your calls for Senator Sanders right after this on our special Monday edition of Brunch with Bernie.
And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our special Monday Brunch with Bernie. You are not hearing a repeat show. Bernie's with us live today. Friday he was not available, and we're doing a makeup, and we're very grateful that he is showing up. Harry in Minneapolis, you're on the air. Thanks for listening to KTNF, and you are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Thank you. I have a couple quick questions. One pertains to what he was talking about last week with his dental plan for Medicare, and I was wondering if that will cover caps and crowns. And then the second question I had was, has anybody ever tried to start, in the Congress, start a government-run pension plan that the private sector employees could contribute to instead of being bailed out after the fact when a corporate raider comes and takes away their pensions? Could they put the money into it and have it government-run and have it more guaranteed that way?
Well, that's an interesting question, Harry. In terms of the dental program that we've introduced, it's pretty comprehensive, and it would cover caps and crowns. As I said last week in introducing this bill, we have a major health care crisis in this country with 50 million people uninsured, and many more who have insurance are paying high deductibles and don't go to a doctor when they should. But very often we forget about dental care, so we have introduced this comprehensive bill, which you can learn about if you go to my website, sanders.senate.gov. But we're going to have a heck of a fight in order to pass that. I don't want to mislead you on that, but it is comprehensive. In terms of pensions, Harry raises a very, very important issue. Tom, something that we should probably spend more time on, and that is all over this country, corporations have cut back on defined benefit pensions, and workers in many respects, because of a decline in their incomes and cutbacks on their pensions, really have not stored away enough money for a dignified retirement. So a lot of working people are very, very anxious about what happens to them when they retire. I think the idea that Harry raises is very optimistic, given who is control, the Republican control, over the House now. But one thing I will say, Harry, is that before we talk about developing a new pension plan, we have got to do everything that we can to save Social Security, which is now under massive attack by the Republicans and some Democrats. So as part of this way to move toward deficit reduction, you're going to have a lot of folks talking about the need to cut back substantially on Social Security, despite the fact that Social Security has a $2.7 trillion surplus and can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 22 years. So one of the most important fights that is going to be taking place here in Washington from today to not only the election day but after the election is how do we move toward deficit reduction without decimating Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid? How do we go about making sure the wealthiest people and the largest corporations start paying their fair share of taxes? How do we take a hard look at the military budget in which we now spend more for defense than the rest of the world combined? So that is going to be one of the most contentious issues that we are going to be engaged in here in Washington, and the American people, I think, have got to contribute to that debate and tell us how they feel.
Jim in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, this is Jim. Tom, Senator Sanders, it's an honor to talk with you. My question is, if we can't overturn Citizens United or get a constitutional amendment, I don't know what the odds of that passing are, can we pass laws to require PACs to be truthful in their ads since they're using public airways? I mean, we complain about all the lies like it's a given, there's nothing we can do. Can't we hold stations accountable for vetting the ads that they put on television or on the radio?
Well, I would suggest to you, Jim, that's an interesting idea, but that's probably not the route that we should go, because what you and I may believe is the truth, somebody else does not. But I'll tell you what we can do, and I'll tell you what we should do while we work to overturn Citizens United with a constitutional amendment. I've offered an amendment. Senator Tom Udall has offered an amendment. Others have. Short term, what we should do is pass what we call the Disclose Act. Right now, there are people who can make huge contributions into the political process without any disclosure whatsoever. And that is just crazy. Second of all, and even more importantly, if I, as a candidate, and I'm running for re-election to the United States Senate from Vermont, if I were to put an ad on television, as I have in the past, I have to say, this ad is approved. I approve this ad. I'm Bernie Sanders. I approve this ad. That is what every candidate has to do. On the other hand, if you are a billionaire corporate owner, you could put on dishonest, ugly, negative 30-second ads, and you don't have to have your face on the television saying who paid for that ad. If we can change that alone, I think it will go a long way toward discourage some of these corporations from putting ads on TV and on the radio. But long-term, in my view, Citizens United is the worst Supreme Court decision that we have seen for a very, very long time. It is undermining American democracy, and in my view, we need a constitutional amendment to overturn it.
Yeah. And let me add for our viewers and listeners that you have proposed a constitutional amendment. People can sign on to that over at sanders.senate.gov, and it's a great start. And there's, you know...
And we have, Tom, on our website, sanders.senate.gov, we have over 200,000 people who have already said that they want to be part of the process of supporting that amendment.
That's great. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. This is a special Monday edition of Brunch with Bernie. We'll be back with your calls for Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can sign up for the Bernie Buzz newsletter over at sanders.senate.gov, and you can sign up for our free newsletter over at tomhartman.com. Check them both out. Welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie, our Monday, a special edition of Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Bernie, you're still here?
I'm right here.
Oh, okay, great. Over in the studios there at the Capitol. And let's see here. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. You are on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good day, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Ed.
I was wondering if anybody in Congress has noted that Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership is virtually identical with George Bush's Security Protection Pact, the thing he tried to put together with Canada, United States, and Mexico. And when Congress found out about it, they went crazy because it was going to strip the sovereignty of the United States away. The Trans-Pacific is also going to do the same thing. And it's interesting that they only changed one letter. They changed an S to a T. It's the same program, just been repackaged, and now Obama claims he doesn't have to submit it to Congress because it's a trade pact and not a treaty. Please,
well,
help
Ed,
us. Don't let
I
this
am not,
happen.
I am not familiar with all of the details, but what I am familiar with is that there is, to a significant degree, a bipartisan coalition around our trade policies, despite the fact that, in my view, and I think the view of most Americans, they have been a total failure. Over the last 20 or 30 years, we have lost millions of decent-paying jobs in this country because large corporations have shut down here, thrown American workers out on the street, and then they've gone to China and to Mexico and to Vietnam and to other low-wage countries, and then they bring their products back into this country. And I think, as most people perceive it, it's harder and harder to buy products made in America. And we've been working on that issue in a variety of ways. But count me in as somebody who does not like our current trade policy, as somebody who has voted against permanent normal trade relations with China, NAFTA, and the other trade agreements, because I think that they are just simply, A, unfair to American workers. And the point that you make is when you sign these international treaties, they take away the power of the U.S. government, state governments, and the American people to formulate policy, which is in our own best interest.
Vincent in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Mr. Sanders, is it at all possible to have one or both houses to introduce legislation that would require companies to bring their jobs back here? I know they wouldn't pass it, but at least you'd have a list of those who say no.
Well, Vincent, no, I don't think you can do that. I think the courts would strike that down at about 5 minutes. I mean, you can introduce anything you want, but I think the courts would strike it down in 5 minutes. But I'll tell you what you can do, which I think would be more effective. I think what we need to do as a nation, as a Congress, is to sit the heads of these large corporations down in front of Congress and have them tell us how they are going to rebuild the manufacturing sector in this country, how they are going to create the millions of jobs we desperately need. I happen to believe, I'm one of those who believes, that you can't have an ongoing sustainable economy if virtually everything that you are consuming in this country comes from China or other countries, that we have got to be producing to a significant degree the products that we consume. And certainly, almost without exception, every major large corporation in America has, over the last 10, 20 years, been involved in significant downsizing. Tom, you will remember the fellow who was head of General Electric before Jeff Immelt.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name.
Yeah, I think it was Jack Welch, wasn't it?
Jack Welch.
Yeah.
That's
right. He's the guy who bragged about he went over to India and looked around when he was selling them a power plant, looked around and said, these people speak English and they'll work for 15 cents an hour. Why do I have back office people and telephone answerers?
What Welch's most famous remark was to the effect, this was the guy who was head of General Electric, who, by the way, got some kind of golden parachute when he retired worth hundreds of millions of dollars. What he said, if I had the power, I would build my factories on barges so that he can go to any part of the world where labor was cheapest. Yep. So if it got too expensive in China, go to Vietnam. If it gets too expensive in Vietnam, go to Cambodia. Go to where people will work pennies an hour. And this is one of the leading industrialists in the United States of America. So I think the issue, the statement that has to be made loud and clear, that if these corporations want us to buy their products, and they most certainly do, they spend enough money on advertising urging us to buy these products, that it is the time is long overdue for them to start building those products in my state of Vermont, in California, all over this country.
Okay, Mark in Auburn, Alabama. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders.
Yeah.
I'm a conservative, but I do respect your stance, and I have a recommendation for a change in our tax policy. The average hold time for a share of stock today is 11 seconds. So the stock market is not a place where individuals go, look at a company, buy in the ownership and participate in good management, good products, et cetera, but rather just kiting nickels and dimes by the speculators. I would like to see a tax that said if you hold a share of stock less than, say, 5 days, that you get an 80% tax and cut out the speculation in the stock market. Would you be in favor of a tax like that?
Yes, I would, Mark. You know, there are different ways that you can approach it. In point of fact, we have already introduced legislation coming from pretty much the same place that you are, and that is that would pay for the dental program that we've introduced. The issue here is that we have a Wall Street today that is, to a significant degree, the largest gambling casino in the world. And as Mark indicated, there are stocks just being bought and sold in lightning speed. And I think what we call a transaction fee on those types of transactions would not only raise substantial sums of money for the government, it would also dampen speculation. And it's speculation in this country is just a huge issue. We have been working very hard trying to get the Commodities Future Trading Commission to end speculation in the oil futures market, where you have over 80% of the oil futures controlled not by people who actually use the product, airlines or fuel dealers, but in fact controlled by Wall Street speculators. So, Mark, yes, that is something that we have introduced legislation to, and it's something that I am sympathetic with.
Matt in St. Louis, Missouri, you're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, what is your opinion of Governor Rick Scott's tactics of voter suppression in Florida? And if you were the president, how exactly would you handle it yourself?
Needless to say, I am strongly opposed to voter suppression. I mean, this to me is a very emotional issue, if you like, because it really goes to the heart and soul of what our democracy is about. We can argue about how much money you spend on education or the military or healthcare, anything else. It's a good debate. But when you are intentionally trying to deny Americans the right to vote or making it more and more difficult for people to vote because they may vote against you, I think that that is an incredibly ugly thing to do. And what I would say, it's not just taking place in Florida. It's taking place in a number of states in this country. When I was mayor of the city of Burlington, from 1981 to 1989, one of my proudest achievements was that we came close to literally doubling voter turnout. We went out of our way. We urged people to participate in the political process. We opened up City Hall to people, and we said, this is your government. Come on in and participate and vote in elections. We came close to doubling voter turnout. And here what you're seeing all over America is governors and state legislatures who are saying, let's see, poor people or minority people or old people might vote against us. How do we make it as difficult as we possibly can for them to vote? And I think that that is, I would hope that regardless of one's political persuasion, one condemns that activity. Voter fraud is a very serious crime, and anybody involved in voter fraud should be punished. But the truth is that in this country, voter fraud is very, very rare. And what people are doing is frightening people about voter fraud and in the process denying throughout America millions of people the right to vote. And I think that's pretty ugly.
Yeah, it absolutely is. We just have, how much time do we have, Jim? Or Shane? Half a minute.
Let me add to that, Tom,
yes,
while we have this half a minute before the
okay.
break. Is Matt asked me what I would do. Well, I think what the president should do is demand that his attorney general be more aggressive in going after the illegal approaches which deny people or make it difficult for people to participate in the political process.
Yeah, I think we all would love to see that. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, special Monday edition. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Bernie's website, Sanders.Senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz. You can sign on for his constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United. The wealthy elite have run roughshod over the lives of everyday Americans for the past several decades. How did we get to this point in American history, and what can be done to fix our broken meritocracy? I discuss the twilight of the elites with MSNBC host Chris Hayes on this week's Conversations with Great Minds at conversationswithgreatminds.com or at tomhartman.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Randy in Smock, Pennsylvania, on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon, Tom. I have a question, Senator Sanders. Have you ever given thought to running for president? If not, why not?
Thank you very much, Randy. No, I have not. I mean, among other things, it costs so much money to run for president that somebody with my views couldn't raise that kind of money. But I'm very proud to be Vermont senator. I'm proud to do this show with Tom every week. But no, I'm not going to be running for president. But thank you very much for your thought.
Josh in Denver, listening on AM 760. You're on the air with Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Senator. My question was about country of origin labeling. Is there you know, what are your thoughts on that? And is there any reason that we shouldn't have maybe 30% of a product's packaging be devoted to the flag of the country it came from, so people have to reach up on Walmart shelves and grab a Chinese flag to buy a Chinese product?
I'm not sure I heard the whole question, but certainly I believe we should have, when people purchase the product, they most certainly should know where that product is manufactured. And I think one of the sad aspects of what's going on in this country is that corporate America, to a significant degree, has sold not only American workers out, but American consumers and moved abroad. Let me just tell you, John, what we're trying to do. Right? This is a small step forward, but it's not unimportant. We have been working for the last couple of years with the Smithsonian Museums here in Washington, D.C., who I discovered really were selling in their gift shops mostly products not made in America, and we're beginning to change that. We've been working with the vendors at the national monuments and our national parks, getting them now to sell more products manufactured in the United States of America. We're now working with the Veterans Administration in their gift shops to get them to be selling more products manufactured in America. But clearly, we've got to go way beyond that. As I said earlier, I'm not sure that you can sustain a strong economy when most of the products we consume come from other countries. We've got to rebuild our manufacturing sector. We've got to make sure our workers are earning a decent wage. And I think that is the direction we have to go if we're serious about growing the middle class.
Lawrence in Berkeley, California, you're on the air with Bernie.
Yeah, hi, Bernie. Hi, Tom. I've got in front of me on the Huffington Post the most interesting economic statistic. It says that people in the bottom 20% of income spend eight times as much of their income on sales taxes as the people in the bottom in the top 1%. In other words, the people in the top 1% only spend one-eighth as much money on sales taxes of their income as poor people do. And why that's really important, it's not just that, yeah, we know it's a regressive and unfair tax, but also we always say that poor people spend more of their income than rich people do, but now we know how much. We know that they spend eight times as much of their income as the top 1% does, and I'm just wondering if that could be used as a talking point, because, you know, with that knowledge, it means that if you equalize income, you know, the amount of money that is spent in the in consumer economy equals approximately the amount of jobs that you can create. And so you can create many more jobs by equalizing income than you can by deficit spending.
Well,
and if you equalize income, you don't need deficit spending.
Well, Lawrence, I think the point that you're making about the very high percentage of income that low-income people spend on regressive sales tax is important. I mean, the clearest example you go to a gas station, you fill up your tank. If you're a billionaire, you're going to fill up your tank and pay the same exact percentage in your federal and state taxes as you do if you are somebody making 10 bucks an hour, and that's true, obviously, in many, many other areas. Warren Buffett, to his credit, Warren is, I think, the second richest guy in America behind Bill Gates, made the point that it is a little bit absurd in America in terms of personal income tax that his effective tax rate is lower than his secretary's. And we saw Mitt Romney himself with his tax returns indicating that his effective tax rates are lower than middle-class people in some cases. So clearly we need to take a hard look at our entire tax system, including sales tax, including corporate taxes, including income taxes, and come up with a progressive system which reflects the reality that we have an incredibly unequal distribution of income in America right now, and that it is absolutely appropriate to ask the wealthiest people in this country to start paying their fair share of taxes.
Okay. Vicki in Valley Springs, California. Just a minute to the break, Vicki. A real quick one for Senator Sanders.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, I just wanted to ask him if he thought there was any real hope for a future for a government that wasn't paid for, you know, by the best government that money could buy, because, I don't know, I feel like I should be a responsible voter, but I'm having a hard time with it right now.
Okay, Bernie,
I mean, I did...
Vicky, the answer is...
Thank you, Vicky.
The answer is, especially with Citizens United, it is getting harder and harder. But do not, if your response is, I'm not going to vote, that is, in my view, exactly the wrong response. What we have got to do is be more aggressive politically. We've got to expose what Citizens United is. We have to make every American understand that when they see this blitz of ugly TV ads against candidates who are trying to represent working people, where that money is coming and why it is on their television set. So not voting is not, I think, an effective response.
Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And we will see you Friday. And up next, John Dean. This is the 40th anniversary of the Watergate break-in. We're going to be looking back on the Nixon administration a little bit, and right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And this is the 40th, this week is the 40th anniversary of the Watergate burglary, the break-in, if I'm getting my years right. John W. Dean is with us, the attorney, author, former White House counsel in the Nixon administration, the author of a bunch of books. My favorites are Blind Ambition, Conservatives Without Conscience, Broken Government Worse Than Watergate, and I thought the Rehnquist choice was pretty amazing. John W. Dean, Justia, JUSTIA.com is the website where you can find his contemporary writings. John W. Dean, welcome back to our program.
Hi, Tom.
It is the 40th anniversary. Do I have that right?
It is,
okay.
Believe it or not. Quick, you were probably too young to be an eyewitness.
In my dreams. I was shall we say, old enough to vote. Just, actually. So I'm curious what your recollection of that time is and what message you think that we all, particularly people who aren't old enough to remember Watergate, what they need to know, what lessons they need to know about that.
Well, what's interesting is in the aftermath of Watergate, there were a slew of reforms, everything from the lead recommendation of the Senate Watergate Committee, which was the creation of an independent counsel, to major changes in campaign finance, to an eras of investigative journalism, and a number of reforms that have just gone, for one reason or another, by the wayside. Of course, the independent counsel law gored both sides sufficiently that Congress decided to let the sunset provision take effect and have it vanish. Campaign finance, the Supreme Court pretty well mauled any effort to restrict funding of presidential campaigns, and public financing went by the wayside for all practical purposes because nobody could conceivably win given the unlimited amounts their opponent could now raise, to the fact that corporate ownership of most news outlets and the Internet have changed journalism so radically that you have very little investigative journalism today. You have ProPublica and a few well-funded foundations that are looking at it, but it used to be the norm of Washington reporting for a while.
I remember Jack Anderson.
Yeah,
you know, in Parade magazine of all things. I mean, everywhere it was like
most state and local major newspapers did a lot of it too in the aftermath of Watergate. They really went after government, tried to keep them honest and what have you. But what happens is it sometimes is not productive. It's expensive, so it's just not a good bottom line item today. And papers that were once willing in the aftermath of Watergate to take the risk no longer can do it. I've talked to journalists about it, and they say, you know, it's not that we don't want to. It's that we have so much on our plate that you just can't do it. You just can't dig very deep on a story anymore, let alone set everything aside and be assigned to one case like Woodward and Bernstein were during Watergate and just dig.
Yeah. Now,
so the message is we had all that. We tried to put reforms in place, and they have gone by the wayside. There are changes, yeah. No question that presidents are no longer given the benefit of the doubt by either the public or the media in post-Watergate. Presidential papers, when not played with by executive order, are theoretically available. We'll see what the Bush White House does with his papers. He's got 12 years to pretty well keep under the law to keep them sealed, but, you know, he issued a number of executive orders that Obama quickly changed when he came in.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens. You know, the big message is, though, it could happen tomorrow, particularly given the massive amounts of money that are now coming into the system under Citizens United.
Yeah. I'm curious your thoughts about a secondary consequence of Watergate and whether you even think this analysis is reasonable. It seems that when Jerry Ford not only pardoned Richard Nixon for not just the Watergate crimes, but basically any crimes, and pardoned a bunch of his buddies, that he established a precedent, if you will. I mean, we haven't had any presidential pardons since then, but you had serious criminal allegations during the Reagan administration of their dealing with Iran in what was called Iran-Contra, and that was never really seriously pursued after the fact. There was this wild investigation into Bill Clinton, into his sex life, but and then George W. Bush. I mean, you wrote a book, Worse Than Watergate, about that administration, as I recall, and it seems that every administration, and then, you know, Barack Obama comes along and says, well, you know, we're not going to look back on whether, you know, crimes were committed in the Bush administration. It's almost like ever since that Jerry Ford pardon, every administration has said, we don't want to look back at the previous administration out of fear that the next one might look back at us. Am I off base on this?
I don't necessarily think it started with Ford. I think there has been something of a president's club for a long time where they don't go after one another and they give each other a pass when they become successor presidents.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon might have been the exception to that he wanted to use his executive powers to dig in and find out what Democratic presidents had done that he could embarrass them with. He wanted to release a lot of classified material in the aftermath of the Pentagon Papers leak. He was determined to just expose every Democrat's secret going back to FDR and World War II. I mean, but most of the stuff earlier than that had already been released.
Mm-hmm.
But presidents do give each other a nod. I think, you know, Ford only pardoned Nixon. No one else really got pardoned.
That, oh, really? I was wrong.
That was the only one. It was Bush 1 who pardoned all the Iran-Contra people. Caspar Weinberger on the eve of trial, and Oliver North did not need a pardon because his case had been reversed, but it's Bush 1 who pardons all the Iran-Contra people.
Huh.
And I think that's just because he, you know, here's a former CIA director, and he just thinks that's the way the game was played. Reagan would pardon Mark Felt from the Nixon era for his black bag jobs on the Weatherman, which had nothing to do with Watergate, but it certainly had a lot to do with the way the FBI operated.
Right.
So you know, and then of course, Clinton would use the pardon not for predecessor but for Mark Rich, and would be severely criticized for that.
Right.
I think it's pretty ad hoc, and what you've seen, though, in the pardon situation is just an increasing decrease of use. In other words, it's done at the last minute of a presidency. If it's in the second term, it's done then. If a guy is defeated and on his way out, he'll use it on his way out in the first term, and that's pretty much been the norm since Ford.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is that, you know, Obama has largely given, you know, the Bush administration just an open pass on war crimes for all practical purposes.
Yeah,
just doesn't want it on the radar.
Yeah, and people like Jay Bybee and John Yoo and I mean Alberto Gonzalez, not to mention George W. Bush and Dick Cheney.
Yeah, I got a kick out of Gonzalez making a comment about Obama's policy on immigration being a great abuse of law. This is a man who is really not well suited to make that statement.
Wasn't Alberto Gonzalez himself an illegal immigrant?
I believe his parents were.
His parents were, yeah, okay. I knew it was one or the other. John W. Dean, the attorney, author of numerous books, Blind Ambition, Conservatives Without Conscience, The Rehnquist Choice, Worse Than Watergate, Broken Government, and writing over at Justia, JUSTIA.com. Mr. Dean, thank you.
Pleasure, always.
Thank you very much. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I got to share with you my take on what happened over the weekend in France and Greece, because it's going to impact America. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Hey, have you noticed how all the news, you know, there's this big election in Europe over the weekend, okay, Sunday. Now, first of all, the Europeans have enough common sense to know that Sunday is the least worked day of the week, and so if you want to have the most people show up and vote, have your elections on Sunday. When are we going to figure that out? I mean, the Constitution specifies the presidential election as a Tuesday, but it doesn't say that states can't at least, you know, hold their elections over a course of a week or two. And a lot of states do. They provide for early voting. But anyhow, I digress. There was this big election over the weekend in France and Greece were the two big ones. And there are two really big things that are largely overlooked by our infotainment media's what would you call it, coverage of the European elections over the weekend. The first is that even the new Greek government and the new Greek leader are calling for changes in Europe's Paul Ryan, Mitt Romney-style austerity that's been devastating that continent. You know, explicitly, or that country, Greece. And the second, and I think this is probably the most important, is that France, the second largest economy in the Eurozone, they account for 21.2%. That's over a fifth of all the economic activity in all of Europe. The second largest country and economy, I believe, in Europe behind Germany, just elected a socialist as president a few months ago, and then this past weekend, yesterday, handed socialists control of both the assembly, their equivalent of the House of Representatives, and their Senate. This is a complete sweep. Now, you're not going to hear, you know, much about this in the corporate media in America, because the corporate media in America, being owned by big right-wing corporations, they're going to be all about, hey, did you see how the Republicans in Greece, or the, you know, the equivalent of Republicans, the conservatives in Greece, won the election? They beat those nasty liberals, those nasty socialists. Actually, first of all, to put the Greek myth to bed, Syriza, the socialist party in Greece, got 5% of the vote in the election before this one. Yesterday, they got almost 20% of the vote. So a 400% increase in people voting for them, even though they were 2.5 points below the you know, New Democracy Party, they still, I mean, a 400% increase. You're not going to hear that in the corporate media in America from the conservative talking heads. And you're not going to hear much about, you know, they will crow and quack and whatnot about how conservatives have won in Greece. They're not going to tell you it was the socialists who won in France. And the socialists in France have a solution for the Paul Ryan, Mitt Romney kind of austerity that's been racking Europe and has tinged the French economy. And that solution is very straightforward. It's to step up government sector spending, raise the minimum wage. These are the things François Hollande ran on. Raise the minimum wage, increase taxes on people who are as rich as Mitt Romney, who, by the way, lived in France to avoid the Vietnam War when he was a teenager, and to drop the retirement age down to 60, thus opening up more jobs for young people. This is what the socialist program is. Over a decade ago, Argentina famously told the IMF where they could shove their austerity ideas, and they decoupled the Argentine peso from the U.S. dollar. They had a bumpy ride for a couple of years, but they're doing fine now. Similarly, Brazil rejected austerity and instead raised their minimum wage, strengthened their labor unions, broadened their health care and social security systems, and raised taxes on the rich. The result of those measures is that Brazil now has one of the strongest and fastest growing economies in the world. You heard of the BRIC countries, BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China, fastest growing economies in the world. Chances are, if you've flown recently on a commuter flight, it was in a Brazilian-made airplane. I mean, they're selling us stuff. Fully half of all the cars in Brazil in that country no longer run on gasoline. Meanwhile, here in the U.S., the Republicans are pushing us to use more fossil fuels, make more money for ExxonMobil, more money for BP, give huge tax cuts to people as rich as Mitt Romney. And by the way, he has proposed that as president, he would cut his own taxes. How bizarre is that? The Republicans campaigning on ending the minimum wage, ending unemployment insurance, ending Social Security, or turning it over to Pete Peterson's buddies on Wall Street, ending Medicare, or turning it over to the big insurance industry bankster executives. I just find it incredible. South America woke up a generation ago and said, you know, you conservatives are crazy. Europe is waking up right now. You had the election yesterday in Greece, a 400% increase in votership for the Socialist Party. You had, and even the so-called Conservative Party that won is saying, you know, we're going to renegotiate this deal with Germany. You got the Socialists swept the board in France. A couple of weeks ago, they had elections in Rhine-Westphalia and the largest state in Germany, and Angela Merkel's party lost to the left-wing parties. So South America woke up a generation ago. Europe is waking up now. How long is it going to take us to wake up and see that Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney are just shills for billionaires and big oil, and to realize that if we follow their siren song of austerity, if we do what the Republicans and Tea Partiers and the House of Representatives passed in the Paul Ryan budget, if we do that, it will destroy our nation the same way it destroyed South America 20 years ago and Europe right now? I mean, how long is it going to be before Americans wake up and say, okay, we get it? You know, Ayn Rand was not only a lousy moral philosopher, she was a lousy economic philosopher. Who is John Galt? Mitt Romney. I saw some idiot the other day wearing a t-shirt that said, who is John Galt? And I wanted to say, it's the Koch brothers. His name is David Koch. That's who is John Galt. It's the billionaires who are running the show from behind the scenes. And that's the essence of Ayn Rand's book. And it screws everything up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, you know, clearly large chunks of America are waking up, but we have a lot of work to do. So Antonin Scalia, he of Supreme Court and corruption fame, and the guy who goes duck hunting with a man who is a defendant before the Supreme Court 3 weeks before ruling in that man's favor, that man being, of course, Dick Cheney. Antonin Scalia, arguably one of the most corrupt Supreme Court justices in the history of that court, and certainly one of the most political. Antonin Scalia has a new book coming out, and Sahil Kapoor over at TPMDC has apparently gotten a copy of it or some pieces of it, and in that book, Scalia is saying basically, what's going on out there? Oh, okay. Scalia is saying basically that the Wickard versus Filburn decision, 1942. Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, part of his New Deal program, they had these price supports for farmers. They were trying to maintain the price of wheat so that small farms would not go bankrupt, to keep farmers in business. And the way they did that was by saying, you may not grow wheat, certain farmers, right? In other words, regulating the amount of the supply in the marketplace to keep the price up. And, you know, this farmer sued and said, I'm just growing this for my own consumption. And the Supreme Court said, even if you're growing it for your own consumption, if because you're consuming it, you're taking wheat that you would have otherwise been buying out of interstate commerce, and therefore the Interstate Commerce Clause gives the federal government the ability to tell you, no, you can't grow wheat for your own consumption. Now, Scalia really liked this 1942 ruling. This is, you know, this is the one that so much of the New Deal and much everything from civil rights laws to the EPA have hung on ever since. You know, the civil rights laws were enforced by saying, well, you know, it's it may be a lunch counter down in Mississippi, but they're serving ketchup made up in Pennsylvania at the Heinz factory. So they're engaged in interstate commerce, and therefore they come under the purview of the United States government. And if they are discriminating against people at that lunch counter, that's the business of the federal government. And all of this went back to this one Supreme Court decision in 1942, Wickard versus Filburn. And interestingly, there was a case called Gonzalez versus Raich, in which a guy who had, he was, I believe he had cancer. He was a medical marijuana patient with a prescription and a license to grow his own marijuana from his state, where it was legal. And in a 6-3 decision, they said, well, under the Wickard decision, this is the business of the federal government, not just the state. And we don't care if the state made it legal for you to grow pot. We're making it a crime. So you go to jail, buddy. Now Scalia is right. Now that the Wickard case, I mean, he endorsed it when he could use it to put somebody in jail for growing medical marijuana. But now that the Wickard case is being used to justify Obamacare, this is the linchpin for Obamacare. How do you justify telling everybody in the country that if they don't have health insurance, they're going to have to pay a fee or a fine? Now, I think the easy way to do it, right, would have been right out of the gate, just say, hey, it's a tax. Everybody in the country has to pay a tax of $7,000 a year for health care. And just like, you know, your income tax or whatever, you can get credits against that tax. In other words, you can get reductions of that tax and based on your income. So if you make under $50,000, you get half off. If you make under $40,000, you get 3/4 off. If you make under $30,000, you don't have to pay that tax at all. You know, it's totally free. And if you make over $1 million, maybe the tax is twice as much. But whatever, if Congress, when they put it together, actually, had just called it a tax, there wouldn't be this issue. But everybody was afraid, you know, they knew that they couldn't even get the one Republican that they did get from Maine. They knew we can't even get one Republican if we use the word tax. So they didn't call it a tax. They should have. But in any case, Scalia, in his new book, is apparently laying out his defense for trying to knock down Obamacare. So it's going to be very, very interesting to see. I mean, Scalia's book is coming out this week. The Obamacare decision is coming out of the Supreme Court either this week or next. And clearly, Scalia is taking the position that he doesn't think that the federal government should be in the business of saying whether or not people have health care. And if he's going to follow that logic, then you can just say goodbye to the Federal Department of Education, to the Environmental Protection Agency, to the Health and Human Services, to right across the board. Because Wickard versus Filburn has been used to justify most of these agencies. And if it's not constitutional, if you're going to overturn Wickard, then this country is going to be a very different place. It's going to literally take us back to pre-New Deal, back to before the New Deal. It's going to take us back to when child labor was legal. It'll take us back to when the minimum wage was unconstitutional. It'll take us back to when the federal government had no right to assert that people have the right to unionize. It'll take us back to a time when the federal government had no right to say that you couldn't discriminate against people based on their race, on their religion, on their gender, on their sexual orientation. Fill in the blank. And the question in my mind, I mean, Scalia realizes the consequences of this. And he was arguing in favor of Wicker just a few years ago when it was used to throw a pot guy in jail. And now he's arguing against it because Obamacare is citing Wicker as their basis. Is he so corrupt? Is Anthony Scalia so corrupt he's willing to blow up basically the entire United States legal system, contemporary legal system, you know, for the last three or four generations, is he willing to blow that up just to take down Obamacare, just to harm President Obama, just to try to end the Obama presidency? Or has he really drunk the Kool-Aid? He says in his book, he says, you know, a lot of what I say in this book contradicts, I'm paraphrasing here, but a lot of what I say in this book contradicts some of my earlier decisions. Obviously talking about the Gonzalez decision. You know, the pot decision. He says, you know, sometimes wisdom comes late. And he says, yeah, here's the quote. Yeah. Because wisdom has come late. That's his phrase. Okay, so if he just got wise to what? And for whom? And why? And did it have to do with going to those meetings with the Koch brothers? Because certainly it's the Koch brothers' opinion that the federal government should not have the power to regulate their paper plants or their oil refineries. That just because the toxins they dump into the river or into the air cross state lines, that doesn't mean that they should be federally regulated. Right? That is clearly the Koch brothers' position. There is this new aristocracy in America that keeps bringing to itself more and more of these people on the fringes of the right and out of the mainstream, like justices on the Supreme Court. That really makes me concerned about the future of this country. Don in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Don, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hi. Enjoy your show, Tom. Question is, Chris Hedges has used the phrase corporate coup d'etat to describe what's happened in the United States. Do you agree with his characterization?
Yes. Yes. I would say that the corruption, I mean, if you go back to Watergate, Lamar, and thank you for the call, Don, Lamar Waldron has written a brilliant book about Watergate now, 40 years later. And in fact, the title of it is Watergate. And Richard Nixon was corrupted mostly by the mafia. Bebe Rebozo and Mickey Cohen and Johnny Roselli and Sandro Trafficante and Carlos Marcello. These guys, you know, they gave him, I mean, bribes in the millions of dollars. What in today's money would be tens of millions to hundreds of millions of dollars. They just nakedly bribed him. That was Nixon's failing. Nixon was our first mob president. Reagan was our first corporate pitchman. He had made a living before he became president pitching for General Electric on GE Theater. He was a corporate pitchman. And they put him in as governor of California, and then they got him in as president of the United States. And he initiated that corporate coup that Chris Hedges is referring to, in my opinion. I can't speak for Chris Hedges. And, yeah, I think that by all means, we are in a corporatocracy right now. And we damn well better quickly wake up and start doing something about it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And what that means, in my opinion, doing something about it, means getting involved in social movements. Getting out there and participating. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, President Obama is at the G20 summit in Mexico, and he had a meeting today with President Putin of Russia. They gave some brief remarks after the meeting, and it was interesting because there's a contrast in the remarks. First of all, President Putin's are very brief. President Obama's are more lengthy, and Putin's are notable for what he doesn't say. He said, we also discussed international affairs, including the Syrian affair. From my perspective, we've been able to find many commonalities pertaining to all of those issues, and we'll now further develop our contacts, both on a personal level and on the level of our experts involved.
Wow. What does that mean?
Second person to ask me that today, and I have absolutely no idea.
Okay. By the way, I forgot to say this is your ad. Talk Radio News is it. This Talk Radio News Service report is brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. So I have paid the bill for you being here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So what else is going on?
Well, I was going to say what the president said. He said they agreed that we need to see a cessation of violence, that a political process has to be created to prevent civil war and the horrific events we've seen over the last several weeks. And they pledged to work with international actors, including the UN, Kofi Annan, and all the interested parties in trying to find a resolution to this problem.
Hmm.
So the difference between the two statements is, I find, very interesting.
That President Obama's was relatively proactive, and that President Putin's, or Prime Minister Putin, which is he now?
He's the president.
Yeah, President Putin's was more subdued.
He said nothing.
You know, I think the thing that a lot of people miss, a lot of Americans miss, you know, there's this screaming headlines over a drudge, you know, Putin is sending Russian warships to Syria, is that
right.
They actually have a small military base there.
Yes.
And, you know, if we had a small military base pretty much anywhere and that country was disintegrating, we would be sending warships to protect our own people as well.
Exactly. And in fact, if anybody clicks on that drug story, within, I think it's the second paragraph of this Associated Press story, it says that.
Yeah.
It says that it's a sign that that they're worried about a sad situation.
Right.
Of course, drudge is not.
This isn't like Russia's going over there to try and kick our butts or something.
No.
I mean, they're doing exactly what we would be doing if we have a military base in South Korea. If South Korea was disintegrating politically and falling into civil war, we would be doing something to get our young men and women there and old ones too out or safe or whatever. I mean, it's, anyhow.
Exactly. Massachusetts Democrat Senator John Kerry is going to play the role of Republican Mitt Romney in President Obama's upcoming debate preparation sessions.
Oh, interesting.
Now, because he ran for president himself, so he's done presidential debates, which most people feel he did well in. He's an experienced debater, not so from those campaigns, and also 5 terms in the U.S. Senate.
Right, and he also has that I'm a very wealthy guy kind of air about him that he can affect. I mean, John Kerry's very good at not doing that now, too. I don't think he did enough of that during the campaign, just letting the ordinary guy through. But he's lived the life of the very wealthy long enough that I think he can do a good Romney imitation, is what I'm saying, because Romney, you know, was born a millionaire and has, in fact, did you see Victoria, how Romney was just going on and on? He saw a truck stop or something yesterday or the day before, one of these order your own, you know, touch screen things, you know, where you can order your own fast food. And he's like, oh, look at this, American technology, isn't this wonderful? You know, you can touch the screen and a can of Coke comes out to you. And I just was thinking George W. Bush with the scanners, or George Herbert Walker Bush, rather.
So he hadn't seen him before?
Apparently not. He even worked it into his stump speech that afternoon, yesterday afternoon.
Wow, but it hasn't become a major story. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, it was reported on by NPR this morning, but that's the only place that I've seen or heard it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. There's a move in the Senate by some senior Senate Democrats to reopen the debate on campaign finance rules. They're pressing for a vote on a constitutional amendment that will grant Congress and the states more authority to regulate federal and state campaign spending and contributions. Judiciary Chairman Patrick Leahy of Vermont said his committee may vote on this proposed amendment sponsored by New Mexico Democrat Tom Udall after a hearing next month. Now, basically, the idea is, they say that this amendment is needed to clarify the authority of Congress and the states to regulate campaign finance in the wake of Citizens United.
So this is an amendment to what piece of legislation?
What it would do, it would grant Congress and the states more authority to regulate federal and state campaign spending and contributions.
Right. Is this an amendment to a budget bill or to what?
This would be an amendment to the Constitution.
Oh, a constitutional amendment. I'm sorry, I missed that critical part. So
yes, a constitutional amendment. And they think they can get some Republicans on board, because there has been something similar done previously. Now, some Judiciary Committee Republicans are against it. Jeff Sessions, Orrin Hatch, John Cornyn, they've vowed to oppose it. John McCain's left open the possibility he would support it, at least sending it to the states for ratification.
Right. Are they going as far as saying corporations are not people and money is property and not speech, or are they stopping well short of that?
I'm pretty sure Leahy's going that far, but he's not quoted as saying that in this piece.
Right.
But they are certainly saying that it's meant to reframe the debate to get support from McCain and other Republicans. They want to get this conversation going.
Fascinating. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. Learn more online at germany.info. And coming up next, one of the most amazing stories out of Louisiana. This is going to make your head explode.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, I just have to lay this out. I public education. You know, the idea that you can go to school for free and get a good education, an education that's good enough that you can get into a college or a trade school or just be prepared for life. Public education in the state of Louisiana is dying. And this is a bellwether for the rest of the country. This is a harbinger. This is a, you know, pick your metaphor, or your adjective or verb or whatever it is. Religious freedom is dying right alongside public education in the state of Louisiana. Earlier this month, the Republican-controlled state, they Republicans have both the state Senate, the state House, and the governorship, Bobby Jindal. The Republican-controlled state legislature approved a new school voucher program in Louisiana that takes millions of dollars away from public schools and throws it via a voucher system into private religious schools, for-profit corporate schools and religious schools, as in teaching kids in Louisiana math, science, and history will no longer be in the hands of qualified unionized teachers working for We the People. Instead, it will be in the hands of profiteers and religious fundamentals who don't believe in science and don't think the history of the world goes back farther than 5,000 years. Now, this new voucher program down in Louisiana accomplishes two goals for the state. One, it hurts the teachers' unions, which tend to support Democrats. And two, it gives the religious right an excuse under the guise of religious freedom to embed their evangelism into the developing brains of the next generation of Americans. And I say the disguise of religious freedom, because that's all it is a disguise. There is no religious freedom in this voucher program. The Republicans and the Democrats who support it had only one type of religious school in mind when they pushed for the program, and that was a Christian school. You want proof? An Islamic school applied for and was approved to be approved under the voucher program. And, you know, they had 30-some-odd Christian schools and one Muslim school. And as soon as it got certified by the state, the Republican lawmakers in the state of Louisiana went flat out, bat guano crazy, over the edge, nuts. Like Republican State Representative Kenneth Havard, who immediately changed his mind about the voucher program when he learned that an Islamic school might be included, saying, quote, "I won't go back to home and explain to my people that I supported this program that will fund Islamic teaching," end quote. And Democratic Representative Sam Jones, who said, "It'll be the Church of Scientology next year." You see, these guys don't give a rat's ass about religious freedom. They are all about Christian evangelism. Now, the Islamic school, trying to avoid a firestorm of hate, withdrew their request to participate in the new voucher program, even though they've been approved. They said, okay, never mind, we don't want the money. Leaving only Christian and private for-profit schools in the mix. So now kids in Louisiana will no longer learn math, science, and history from professional teachers who work for We the People. Instead, they'll be taught by businessmen and religious fanatics who don't believe in science and think the history of our planet began 5,000 years ago, and will be paid for by Louisiana's taxpayers and you and me. Because, you know, federal funds constitute a not insignificant portion of education funds these days. I got to tell you, right about now, our founding fathers, in unison, are doing a barrel roll in their graves. That's because, unlike these politicians in Louisiana, our founding fathers, by and large, I mean, Patrick Henry is probably the only one who is a Christian evangelist. The rest of them, they didn't think religion had any place in our government. You might have noticed how the Constitution says a lot, but it says nothing about God, nothing about Jesus, nothing about Christianity, nothing about the Bible, and nothing about a creator. And even in the Declaration of Independence, where John Adams argued very strongly that Thomas Jefferson has to put in, you know, the creator, God. So Jefferson wrote it as nature's God. Nature's God? What, a Wiccan? You go back and you look at the drafts of the Declaration of Independence, and John Adams, John Jay, and Ben Franklin edited the Declaration of Independence over a 2 or 3 day period after Thomas Jefferson wrote the first draft. And those edits still exist. And you can see where John Adams scratched out nature's God and wrote the Christian God. And Thomas Jefferson scratched out the Christian God and wrote nature's God. So anything. And I say this as a guy who calls himself a Christian, but nonetheless, really, the only thing that the Constitution says, that was the Declaration, the Constitution doesn't say anything about God or Jesus or anything. Creators. The only thing it says about religion is in Article 6, Section 3, where the Constitution says, and I quote, "No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States." Now, why would they say that? Because they got it that religion had been a major source of oppression throughout history. Most of the founding fathers were not Christians. They were deists who believed that the universe had a creator, but that that creator had nothing to do with the daily lives of humans and certainly did not intervene in the world through miracles or religious texts like the Bible. embracing this deism, Benjamin Franklin wrote in 1728 about why he didn't pray. He said, I cannot conceive otherwise than that he, the infinite Father, expects or requires no worship or praise from us. Another founding father, Thomas Paine, wrote in his book, The Age of Reason, all national institutions of churches, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, that would be Muslim, appear to me no other than human inventions set up to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit. End of quote. From the guy who arguably triggered the American Revolution. Historian Barry Schwartz described our first president, George Washington's, religious beliefs, writing, quote, George Washington's practice of Christianity was limited and superficial because he was not himself a Christian. He repeatedly declined the church's sacraments. Never did he take communion, and when his wife Martha did, he waited for her outside the church, outside the sanctuary. Even on his deathbed, George Washington asked for no ritual, uttered no prayer to Christ, and expressed no wish to be attended by his church's representative. End of quote. And as Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1814, long after the Constitution was ratified, Christianity never is nor ever was a part of the common law. In 1796, our nation signed a peace treaty with Tripoli, now we call it Libya. In this treaty, negotiated by the George Washington administration and signed by President John Adams, our founding fathers made very clear the religious nature of the United States when they wrote, quote, the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, end of quote. Unfortunately, more than 200 years after the Treaty of Tripoli, politicians in Louisiana and elsewhere around the nation are trying to reinvent the United States as a Christian nation, going against everything, even the Christians, among our founding fathers wanted for this secular nation that they'd created. Another one of our founding fathers, James Madison, warned in 1803, the purpose of separation of church and state is to keep forever from these shores the ceaseless strife that has soaked the soil of Europe in blood for centuries. It's time to stop giving public tax money to evangelists and promote quality, free, and religion-free public education again, like we used to do. You know, back when we put men on the moon, created the middle class, established generations of entrepreneurs, scientists, engineers like the world had never seen before. That is the American way. So I just want to let you know what Bobby Jindal and those Republicans down in Louisiana are up to, because I'll bet you it's coming to your state soon.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we need to be pushing back against all this corruption of, first they corrupt us with money, now they corrupt us with religion. What's next?
We don't need no education.
Yeah. Well, that's become the mantra of the Republicans, right? They've got this new school that qualifies. I'm just reading about this morning. There's a new school that qualified for vouchers, for public vouchers, that's online. Now, you know, I'm a big fan of homeschooling. One of our three kids, we homeschooled, and she went to an online school. So I'm not just, like, totally trashing the idea. But to just say we're going to replace our public schools with good luck, kid, here's a computer, that makes no sense to me. I mean, Louise and I were in a relatively unique position when our youngest decided that she wanted to homeschool, in that we had sold a business and retired to Vermont and you know, I was just writing books, and we had a lot of time. We could be part of that homeschooling. But most parents don't have that luxury. Anyhow, Lee in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, you got some inside skinny on Bobby Jindal?
Oh, Tom, you said William?
Yeah, it says Lee here, but if your name is William, that's fine. You're calling from Baton Rouge, right?
Yeah, Tom, I got a big question for you.
Okay.
On that last election with Bobby Jindal in it, mm-hmm. He won in the primary, and I don't understand that. He was the incumbent, so he should have been separate. They should have ran the Democrat to see who the Democrat was to go up against him. But he was on the ticket with 12 other people. Some of them was Democrats, some of them were Republicans running as Democrats.
So he ran to replace himself? You
exactly.
Mean you have nonpartisan primaries in Louisiana?
No, we've got Republicans, Democrats, and then they got independents. They, he was on a ticket in the primary with 12 other contestants.
Right.
In the primary. But it never went to a general election because he got 40-something percent of a vote. I don't understand how that works.
Well, I don't either. I don't know how the Louisiana election system works, Lee. But it sounds like if he won the primary for both parties, well, I don't know. I would just be speculating. But, Lee, thanks for the insight. I mean, you know, we'll have to keep an eye out for this. And thank you very much. Mark in Las Vegas. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hey, earlier you were talking about the Koch brothers, and I asked your screener how old they were, and he said they were born in about 1940, so they're getting up there in years. You know, what is it exactly they're looking to do at this point? They're elderly. They've got everything in life that they need or want. You know, what kind of legacy is it that they're looking to leave, and to who?
Yeah. I believe, I don't know, and you know, you're asking me to look inside somebody else's heart, and I can't do that.
I mean, do they have children? What do these children think? You know, because they're two of the main reasons why people are uneducated, you know, between their financing of the American Enterprise Institute and these conservative think tanks.
And the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, Reason Foundation, Reason Magazine.
Yeah, they've got their fingers in all that pie,
sure.
You know. But when they die, one thing we could hope is that a lot of that nonsense will die with them.
Well, you know, I don't want to speculate about or wish them death. I mean, that's not...
Hey, you know, whether we wish it on them or not, they're going to pass away, you know.
Yeah.
As far as I know, nobody survived.
The question about what their legacy is, I've known people like this in my life and who truly believe this ideology. And you read Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, and, you know, the arc of the story is basically the billionaires went on strike. You know, the job creators decided that they were going to go off and just say to hell with it. We're tired of dealing with the unions, basically, and the bureaucrats.
But then those folks in that book had to get together, so they couldn't do anything on their own anyway.
That's right. And the book
philosophy is false.
And the book doesn't disclose how once they got together, you know, who cooked their meals, who paved their roads. I mean, you know, it's like the book is a fantasy, right? The book is just a plain old fantasy, but. There are people who believe this stuff and truly believe it, that you know, this idea that, you know, it's kind of the Wild West.
Say we go through with this idiotic business of continuing to privatize infrastructure, okay? That means that these companies that are making money on one end are going to have to pay somebody else a lot of extra dough to move their goods around, too. So they're going to find out
unless
that there's a downside to this.
Well, maybe. I mean, you could see where vertical integration has reached the point of absurdity. I mean, you've got companies that are drilling oil and selling it retail as gasoline and doing everything in between, including the transport of it. So, you know, the day may come when Walmart starts buying major interstate highways so that they can more easily transport goods from their ports in California, from their manufacturing facilities in China to their stores.
Yeah, it may happen that
And they
way,
pay but, themselves. And then they make a profit on all the rest of us who need to use the road.
But then they'll be in a war with somebody else who doesn't like that idea, and it'll be some other corporation.
Well, maybe. Which, I mean, this is the problem with monopoly, you know, monopoly corrupted capitalism. This is where we're at right now, is you have so few companies that can take them on. Because we haven't been enforcing the Sherman Act, I mean... If they bought enough interstate highway, who's going to challenge them?
I agree with you, but the law of unintended consequences has a habit of biting everybody at some point.
Yeah, I don't disagree, and my personal opinion is that this whole privatization and the associated austerity programs that go along with it, that there's really no other word for the Ryan budget and for the Republicans' budget. That the outcome of these will be the same as the outcome of, you know, less government and business, more business and government, which was the slogan of the Warren Harding administration in 1920, or his campaign. That
now,
you know, the outcome of that was the Great Depression.
Yeah, now how did that turn out again?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, actually, you know, they had nine, they had a good 9-year run. It was a wild bubble. They called it the Coolidge prosperity in the middle of it, you know, the Hoover prosperity toward the end of it, and then the bubble burst. And I personally think this bubble's going to burst. And I mean, we're in a deflating bubble right now that still is in the process of bursting. But what their legacy is, I can't say. It's going to be just very interesting to watch. Mark, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the very incredibly ugly. And your calls right after this. Be the good, the bad, and the very, very proceliusmatically ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good, Team Romney Mobile. As Mitt Romney travels across America in his campaign bus, Team Romney Mobile, a project of MoveOn.org, will be right behind him. And they'll be taking Seamus along for the ride. The team will be driving in a Cadillac Escalade, which they say is an automobile for the 1%. Cadillac is covered in bumper stickers of American corporations who have contributed to Romney's campaign. And to top it off, there's a stuffed dog on the roof representing Seamus, the Romney family dog placed on the roof for a 12-hour car ride as part of a family trip. So while Romney tours the country preaching his how to screw over the 99% policies, it's great to hear the Team Romney Mobile will be right behind him reminding Americans of how out of touch this ultimate one percenter is with the rest of the nation. The bad. Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio. If you're Arizona's most famous anti-immigrant birther sheriff, how do you respond to President Obama's new immigration policy? Well, you arrest a 6-year-old undocumented immigrant. Just hours after President Obama announced his new immigration policy, Arpaio and his office arrested 15 alleged illegal immigrants, including a 6-year-old girl. And Arpaio told reporters that he will continue to arrest young undocumented immigrants despite the president's new policy. Arpaio is currently under investigation by the Department of Justice for violating numerous civil rights laws and for using taxpayer resources in his birther witch hunt of President Obama. So doing something as low as arresting a 6-year-old child really shouldn't come as that much of a surprise. And the very, very ugly Florida Secretary of State Ken Detzner. Detzner, who has played a large role in Governor Rick Scott's voter purge of thousands of eligible voters, was interviewed about the purge by a local television station this weekend. When asked about concerns that have been raised over the voter purge, Detzner said that purging voters off the state's rolls was his, quote, passion, end quote, and that he had, quote, a moral duty, end quote, to continue the process. So Mr. Detzner's passion in life is to take away the right to vote, one of America's most fundamental rights, from thousands of Floridians. That is very, very ugly. No other way to describe it. None. Absolutely none. No way! Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. Gosh, I've almost forgotten. On the anniversary of Watergate, I almost hate to raise this because it sounds crazy, but I remember hearing recently on radio, I think, that the plumbers were originally kind of put together by Nixon, who now seems really like a great president compared to the latest crop of Republicans. So I hate to pick on him anymore, but that he, Jack Anderson was delving into some of the background stuff on Nixon, and that Nixon kind of wanted to have somebody take care of him, and that they were these guys were hired or brought in. The guys actually who were the plumbers. He actually bumped into Jack Anderson at the airport inadvertently as they were coming in for this to do this deed on him. So I feel strange. You know, to me, it's a huge, would be a very interesting story. I've never heard another thing about it.
Yeah.
So
the Nixon had been involved. He had been paid off and bribed by the mob a couple of different times, and he had involved the mob in an effort in '72 to assassinate Castro. He thought it would help his reelection chances, and he was afraid that word of his affiliation with these mafia guys was that Castro had created this document listing all of the assassination attempts against him, and he had shared it with the president of Chile. And so the plumbers broke into the Chilean embassy looking for this document, and they were looking for anywhere else it might have landed, and Nixon was paranoid. He was afraid that the Democrats had it, so break into the Democratic headquarters. He might have thought Jack Anderson had it, or that might have been a separate little witch hunt. But that's basically what they were looking for. They were looking for a document that was put together that listed all of Nixon's, not just Nixon's, but all of the United States assassination attempts against Castro, and had been put together by Castro. And it revealed, Lamar Waldron actually published the document. It is now public information. He published it in his new book on Watergate that just came out a week ago. So
I want to thank you. You do a really great job, by the way, and I don't mean to be – I mean, I did, you do. And thanks for keeping it up. And
sure.
So admire what, how you handle your show and the people calling. So
thank you, Richard. Thank you for your kind
You're
words.
Welcome.
I appreciate it. Gene in Reading, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gene, what's on your mind?
Well, you were talking about the funding of the vouchers for the schools down in Louisiana.
Right.
I guess what I don't understand is, I mean, I have an environmental degree myself, and I've worked in the environmental area for 23 years now. And just what the people on the outside don't know, you know, what you try to tell them when you're out in the field, when I'm doing my job, it's amazing to me that anyone, especially some of these half-baked preachers that are out there, would even get a hold of these kids and fill their minds up with whatever. I was just reading something in the latest edition of the intelligence report from the Southern Poverty Law Center,
mm-hmm.
And they watch these different groups. Well, what I was shocked to see is how many of these groups are attached to the Republicans in some form or another.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a person from my area that was mentioned. And also, there was something in there, and I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something to the effect that one of these preachers was saying you couldn't catch HIV from a heterosexual relationship. Now, when I read that, my jaw dropped.
Yeah.
I mean, you have this coupled with, you have high-ranking people. I think Ron Paul has said something about he wanted to abolish the vaccine program.
Right.
I don't know if I'm correct on that. You're talking about, you know, you wrap this into everything you've talked about the last hour as far as where America is going. I just can't believe that this kind of stuff is going on, yet, you know, all these people that are making money depend so much on science for what they do. I have people who work around me who have higher degrees than me that went to see a guy like Glenn Beck.
Hmm.
I mean, up is down, you know, left is right.
Yeah.
You would think somebody like him who seems to have no education in anything, it's very disheartening. And I guess when I hear you guys talk, and I'm glad somebody's talking about this, I'm glad somebody's out there. I'm in a rather conservative area. And, you know, I feel like when I talk to people that I know, it's a very uphill battle.
Sure.
I've talked to people already that, you know, the world's only 5,000 years old. I mean, they're convinced of
yeah.
this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's extremely frightening to me because I guess I don't understand, you know, where they're coming from. We've gotten this far with what we know, and it's almost like we're going to have the Scopes Monkey Trial all over again.
Yeah, well, remember the outcome of the Scopes Monkey Trial. I mean, you know,
well, I realize
we lost.
I know, but do we have to relive that whole, you know, how many people have to be hurt because of these arguments? I mean,
our nation is being hurt. We are no longer competitive. You know, in science and math, we're in the 30th or 40th in the world. I mean, we're there with Slovenia.
It's, you know, and it's unbelievable. I know this is a little off topic, but it seems like I don't understand the middle class anymore, and I don't understand, are we that concerned with being able to be comfortable in a recliner and texting our friend who's sitting at the table across from us? Are we that obsessed with that? Is the middle class that is obsessed with that that we can't realize? I mean, you know, when I talk to people around me, it's upsetting that what they say to me sometimes is parroting exactly what they see on television.
Yeah. I think those are more symptoms than cause, but I would submit to you that what we are seeing now has originally started out as an attempt to roll back the New Deal. To roll back the idea that, you know, we're all in this together, that there's a role for government, the thing that is sometimes referred to as democratic socialism or European socialism, the small piece of it that came to the United States was Social Security, unemployment insurance, minimum wage laws, the right to unionize. It started out as an effort to roll that back. And it has become an effort to roll back the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment, which began in the 17th century, in the 1600s, with Thomas Hobbes writing Leviathan in 1634, publishing it in 1634, and then Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the 1660s, and Thomas Hobbes in the 1670s, his second treatise on government, and, you know, led
to... Think about it, you know, if that is the case, then when you look at the hardships that the people had at the times these things were being written before we got the technology that we got, yeah. Is that what you want to return to?
Is that what? I'm sorry, say that again.
Is that what these people want to return to? They talk
yes.
about the 1800s like it was a three-ring fun circus.
Yeah.
People were sick. I mean, it was a hard, hard life then.
Well,
I don't think people really realize what they have now.
Yeah, people don't. I think the average American doesn't realize that if you adjust for inflation, you know, I mean, right now the mean household income in the United States, or individual income, rather, is $26,000 a year, roughly. If you adjust for inflation, the household income in the United States is around $46,000, as I recall, because typically there's more than one person working. If you adjust for inflation, the income in 1900, before the New Deal and before even Teddy Roosevelt's Square Deal, it was under $10,000 a year in today's dollars. And, you know, and the costs were commensurate with today's. I mean, in other words, America was widespread poverty, a very small middle class, and a very small wealthy elite. And most people were the working poor. And you ask, perhaps rhetorically, but I'll tell you, it's true. You know, do these guys want to take us back to those times? In fact, before the Enlightenment, when basically you had kings, you had nobles, and you had serfs, right? A small group of very wealthy, the kings, a small group of kind of the middle class, the nobles, and a large group of the working poor, the serfs. Yes, that's what they want to take us back to, because they view that as stable.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check out Russell Kirk's book. It was published in 1951. It's The Bible of Conservatism, The Conservative Mind. Number one is stability. Indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dave in Ankeny, Iowa. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to, maybe this your listeners could understand. I have a friend that has a rich grandfather that made this town I live in. And he was asked that question one time. What more do you have to have? You have everything you absolutely need. And he held up his thumb and his index finger and put about a quarter inch between them and said, just that much more than I had yesterday. They're never satisfied. They have to have a little more than what they had the day before. They can never stop. He was 87 years old when he died, about 89. And his kids that go on with the same legacy that his father had.
Yeah.
That's what rich people think.
I agree. And not all rich people, of course, but some people who have pursued wealth to the exclusion of everything else in their lives, this is obsessive compulsive disorder gone wrong.
Right, their hobby. It's a hobby they can't stop.
Yeah, that they can't, and the they can't stop part of it is the key to it. Dave, thank you very much. Well said. Katie in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Katie, what's up?
Yeah, hi. I was getting back to the education,
mm-hmm.
not really about vouchers, but what your personal thought might be on homeschooling, as that's been a decision my sister made with her husband, and they are polar opposites, which brings me to kind of how opposites attract in general, and diversity is good and mm-hmm. all that. But, you know, they were able to raise three children who have, you know, very diverse viewpoints and their own viewpoints, and,
mm-hmm.
You know, and you've got a Democrat and a Republican living together, making it work.
Mm-hmm.
They disagree, they fight, but they get along really for the most part, and they agree to disagree and
mm-hmm.
leave things alone. And the same thing is, though, these kids are great. My kids go to public school, though, and they're learning about biodiversity and Bob Marley and some of the things you're talking about may be out there, but they're not, at least in my life, they're, and we're not rich, but we're comfortable and make good decisions, and And I don't know if that's just from our upbringing, but I didn't have it easy all the time.
What's your question or your point?
No, I asked you what you felt about homeschooling.
Oh, I'm all in favor of homeschooling for people who can do it. I told the story.
But how do you make the decision of who can? What if someone isn't able to do it? That's a difficult, you know, if you start intruding and making things government run, I do think you run other risks too. And you just talked about wealthy people that give their money away. Well, if you start forcing them to pay more taxes, I don't know if they would give that money away. Maybe they would.
Well, back to your homeschooling question. You asked how can you, you know, I said for people who can do it. And the way that you would, you know, we as a society have a stake in having an educated populace. And we as a society have a collective stake in making sure that kids, whether they come out of a public school, a private school, mm-hmm. or homeschooling, have a basic education. And so right. I think that it's entirely reasonable to say that there is some kind of standardized testing. And I'm not a big fan of standardized testing, but I don't know any other metric to measure it with,
right.
that there's some way of determining that this child actually has gotten an education.
But I can
tell you, our youngest, I mean, all of our kids went to public elementary schools and junior high schools, but in high school, our middle child went to a private school, and our youngest was homeschooled. And
that's interesting. My sister's children,
and she just graduated from college yesterday.
Yeah, and my sister's children took different paths as well. They went to the homeschooling in the beginning and high school later. I personally couldn't stand to do homeschooling, so I didn't.
So I think
I'm
it should be
parent.
A choice.
I think I'm a decent parent, and I think most parents try their best. So
I agree, Katie. I get it, and thank you very much for the call. I just think that we need to have some sort of, you know, rational standards. Tony in Stafford, Virginia. Hey, Stafford. Stafford.
Yeah.
Hey, Tony. What's
doing?
Up?
I'm calling about, you know, that Louisiana where there's for chartered schools and all that, vouchers.
Yep.
Well, that's happening throughout, like in Pennsylvania, the school, they're closing schools in Philadelphia on account of charter schools and all that.
Yeah. But this isn't just charter schools. This is charter schools typically have to have a secular function. This is explicitly religious schools.
Yeah.
And
but my thing is, who's going to control what the kids learn? In other words, like a county school or public school, you have the school board setting the curricula for the kids.
Right. So you have public input.
Charter school, you only have maybe the CEO of the company.
Yeah.
Setting the curricula.
Yeah, and this is a strong argument for not having privatized education. On the other hand, you're always going to have people who have enough money that they can send their kids to private schools. We've had private schools since the founding of this country. They're not going to go away. The question is whether we're going to support them with our tax dollars. And that's the line that I think reasonably we should not cross, and that we have been crossing ever since, largely since the Reagan administration, particularly over the last 15 years or so. You know, that's where I would do it. Thanks a lot for the call. Matt in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to say in Louisville, Kentucky, is in Jefferson County in Kentucky, and it's not known, at least in the last 20 or 30 years, as being the greatest public school system in the country.
Mm-hmm.
I've actually had parents be arrested, I think at least three different instances where parents fake their address, their residence, as in Oldham County, which is an adjoining county, and they're sending their kids to Oldham County schools because they don't have the means to send their kids to a private school, but are so have such little faith in the system that they're in that they, you know, they go to those kinds of extremes. Yeah. My wife went to public school her whole life. I went to Catholic school and was raised Catholic, but I'm nearly atheist now. We're sending our daughter to a Montessori school, which is a private school. For those who aren't familiar, it's a lot more.
And they work quite well. Matt, you got 10 seconds to make a point.
I don't think your assessment of evangelical teachers is correct.
Okay. All right. You know, I agree with you. There are some religious schools that do a very good job, and the Catholics in particular have been putting them together for a long, long time. I just don't want them doing it with my tax money. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, the fight against corporate personhood continues around the country. I'll be speaking with Governor Brian Schweitzer of Montana on his efforts, plus the Romney Roadshow rolls into Madison, Wisconsin. We'll tell you about that. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.